Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Boy, that opening music from Tony Funderburk, perhaps today more significant than ever, intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. If you and I are alike, then we're both familiar with what it's like to be amazed at the things we learn in science, as we look with wonder at each new discovery of how the universe and its contents function. But conversely, I don't get amazed when I see an example of the effects of Darwinian evolution and much of the science stopper that Darwinism has become on the progress of biology. You know, I think I'm jaded. After debating Eugenie Scott back in the 1990s, and she said to me that junk DNA was her best evidence for evolution, and then I, a non-scientist talk show host, suggested, Jeannie, don't you think we're only at the beginning of our understanding of genetics? Isn't it way too early to say that these stretches of DNA, these non-coding portions of our genetic double helix molecule, maybe we just don't know enough yet to say they have no function? And she said, oh no, we affirmatively know they have no function. Fast forward to 2016, and scientists are multiplying by the tens of thousands saying that this stuff has function. So, I'm a bit jaded, but reading a major new book by Dr. Douglas Axe on intelligent design, I was stunned. This book is titled Undeniable: How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed. It's out from HarperCollins. I highly recommend it. Well, what stunned me is how many years after Watson and Crick elucidated the genetic molecule DNA, what was that, in the early 50s, 1950s? And then how many years after that, scientists were still groping in the dark about proteins and how they folded and how important was the arrangement of the amino acids, maybe 150 or 200 or more amino acids all lined up in a long strand attached, and then they fold into a tiny three-dimensional functional component of a living cell. How could it be almost half a century and such a little amount of progress had been accomplished? Well, when the progress came, it came with a bang and a shot and a lot of criticism of one particular researcher at the world's most prestigious protein molecular biology research complex over at Cambridge University in England, and that angst was directed at Douglas Axe, the poor guy. So, to talk all through this, what an honor it is to have, for the first time on Real Science Radio, Dr. Douglas Axe. Dr. Axe, welcome to Real Science Radio.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, you're so very welcome. And I would love to begin by asking you about a feedback loop, because in radio, a feedback loop is a terrible thing.
But God is a big whine or something.
Yes, but in molecular biology, I think it's essential for life. You were back at Berkeley in your undergraduate work when you first encountered a feedback loop, and you had a great reaction to it. Could you tell us what a feedback loop is?
Sure. So the example I use in my book is your house thermostat. You set the temperature on the thermostat to keep the house temperature at a comfortable level, and the thermostat is measuring the temperature and then making a decision based on that measurement as to whether to turn the heat on, turn the heat off, turn the air conditioner on, turn the air conditioner off. And those decisions affect the very thing that's being measured. So when the heat goes on, the temperature, hopefully, of your house goes up. When the air conditioner goes on, the temperature goes down. The thermostat keeps measuring the effect of the thing it's controlling and then keeps controlling. So that's the idea of a feedback loop. The very thing that's being measured is being acted upon to change that measured thing, temperature in the case of the house. Well, as an engineering student at UC Berkeley, I was learning about the theory of these control systems, theory is what it's called, how you action a feedback loop when you're trying to control chemical processes, for example. And it turns out to be a lot more complicated than the simple thermostat for complex chemical processes. Now, after having studied that as an engineering student, I find myself 4 years later or so, 3 years later at Caltech, as a graduate student, taking a class on molecular genetics and learning that, lo and behold, feedback loops are used at the molecular level by cells to turn on, turn off even finely regulate the extent to which a gene is turned on according to the needs of the cell. And the specific mechanisms that are used to do this are remarkable. I was learning about this for the first time. Instructor up front showing one of these mechanisms for turning on and off a particular suite of genes in bacterial cells. And I thought, sitting there, that is remarkable, and that is engineering. And it's made all the more remarkable because it's engineering at the molecular level. It was that experience that really set me on a trajectory of thinking about, scratching my head, thinking about, could I do the work that would determine whether things like this can evolve or whether they are indeed designed as they appear to be?
You wrote that you were delighted when you learned about this. You felt laughter welling up within you. And, you know, we could all relate to that. The fabulous videos and cellular animation done by the Discovery Institute, Illustra Media, dear friends of Real Science Radio. And you see the things that, what I like to say, I'm also the pastor of Denver Bible Church. I like to say, look what the Lord hath wrought. I mean, this kinesin protein, it's like a two-footed leg that's marching along a railroad track that's being built just ahead of it, just in time.
When you first see those videos, you think this can't be real, but they are real. And this is happening at the molecular scale, yeah.
Yeah. So if we could talk about this just for a moment. I know it's not the focus of your book at all, but it seems like just the feedback loop is a showstopper for Darwinism. Because let's say you had this purported first cell or your first million cells, whatever, and one of them figured out how to produce something good, like a protein. If it didn't immediately have a feedback loop to control production, wouldn't that new ability just wipe out the cell? Because it would just oversupply. It would just say, hey, I know how to make XYZ protein, and I just start making them.
It certainly could, because it's not necessarily good to make a protein. You need to make the right protein at the right time. And as you move into more complex life forms, beyond bacteria, but to higher life forms that have tissues, they have various different cell types, you have to be turning off and on proteins according to where you are in the organism. Mm. And it can be very harmful to have the wrong protein come on, or a protein come on at the wrong time or in the wrong place.
Well, in the history of manufacturing, JIT, they call it just-in-time inventory, that was a very late development. That took a lot of sophistication. And you've got cells that need all kinds of resources that the cell produces, and to do it at the right time in the right quantity, and don't make an oversupply, don't exhaust your resources, that alone seems wildly sophisticated.
That was the thought that occurred to me as an engineer, seeing that.
So you write about Darwin's speculation. Again, this is just in passing, but that life began in a bit of warm water. And I have a question for you about that. Everyone knows that water is vital for maintaining life, but water is the universal solvent. Doesn't it dissolve stuff really well? And things like polymers, amino acids lined up. If you have that stuff in some kind of prebiotic soup, I think they've found out in laboratory experiments that water is the enemy and it dissolves that stuff. Is that your experience? Is that a valid objection to, if we find water on Europa, that means life would have arose on Europa, for example?
Well, certainly the jump from there is water, therefore there must be life is ridiculous. Life is a whole lot more complicated than water, though, as you said, water is certainly necessary for life as we know it. But it's also true that there are chemicals and compounds that are necessary for life as we see it that actually need to be guarded from the water, or they're only somewhat stable in water. RNA is an example of that. I used to work with RNA for some of my experiments, and it's much less stable than DNA is in water. DNA will last for a long time in solution, but RNAs tend to be much more labile. They'll tend to break apart. And there are other compounds that are not at all stable. And in living cells, what happens is when you make one of these unstable compounds, you usually hand it off very quickly to the next protein system that needs to use it without exposing it to the solvent.
Mm. Here in Denver, we have the Denver Museum of Natural History, and there's an exhibit, and it asks, referring to a famous experiment, it said, did scientists make life in the lab? And we think, well, that was like 50 years ago. Haven't they figured out if they made life in the lab yet? But it turns out when they have manufactured amino acids, they very quickly have to, I think you just described this, take them out of the experiment because the water will just degrade them.
That's the Miller-Urey kind of experiment.
Yes.
That was done in the 1950s where they thought, wow, we've got some brown goo and it's got some amino acids in it. It won't be long before we explain life. But that turned out to be very optimistic, to put it mildly.
Yes. So, Doug, could you tell us now about your time when I read the history of what happened and your part in it at Cambridge, the Laboratory for Molecular Biology, and then the Protein Engineering Center. It was a stunning account of that part of the history of science. Could you share some of that with us? And I'd like to ask you questions about it.
Sure. So when I had this realization at Caltech, I immediately started thinking, this is what I want to do. Actually, it was unfolding over a period of months or a year. I started to rearrange my PhD research project to equip myself to start to do work on proteins and specifically to look at the question of protein evolution. And I ended up getting a postdoc at Cambridge University, which was the perfect place to get the added training that I needed to become an expert in that area. So I went to Cambridge University. A few years later, found myself at this Medical Research Council Center, which is just a couple miles down the road. And this has just an amazing history behind it, in that it was founded by a group of Nobel laureates, or soon to become Nobel laureates. Perutz and Kendrew were leaders, and below them were Francis Crick and James Watson, who got the Nobel Prize in 1962 for discovering the double helix, the same year that Perutz and Kendrew got the Nobel Prize for determining the first protein structures. And then there was Fred Sanger, who is another Nobel laureate, got the prize in 1958, I believe. So this whole cluster of amazingly successful molecular biologists basically founded a lab that became like the birthplace of molecular biology in 1962. I found myself there in that mix many years later, but Max Perutz, who was the initial head of the LMB, was still there in his 80s, an old man. He would still walk around the halls and was still involved in research. And I got the opportunity to interact with him and share some of my ideas, shared a paper with him, got his reaction. It didn't go as well as I thought it would. I tell a story in the book of him being kind of more upset than appreciative of a project that I shared a paper, a manuscript with him. But as I described in the book, I just learned from that science is not entirely about recognizing the truth from experiments and moving forward and letting go of old ideas when they're disproven. There's the human element that doesn't want to let go of old ideas, and the human element of falling in love with our own ideas and not liking some of those ideas to be challenged.
Doug, there's competition, there's pride, there, like you said, all the typical human elements that science is obviously run by human beings. Now, when you ended up at the LMB, that in and of itself was extraordinary. This is so enviable. A scientist all over the world. Just this past fall, my producer and I went over to England. We did research at Oxford for a debate that we were preparing for. And we wanted to get to Cambridge, ended up interviewing professors at Liverpool and Portsmouth and elsewhere. But we never got to Cambridge, unfortunately. But you were there, and you were at the center of this crucial area of scientific investigation. So for one, I just want to congratulate you. It's an astounding accomplishment. But
well, thank you.
You're welcome. But while you were there, if I understand it as an amateur, the world of biology was wrestling with forming these proteins. And each protein is a different kind of biological component of a cell. And the Darwinian world, just like with junk DNA, they wanted these proteins to be simple. And just a couple particulars, whether something is hydrophobic or hydrophilic, whether amino acids liked water or didn't like water, and put the parts that didn't like water on the inside and the parts that like water on the outside, and pretty much you'd get a protein. And that seemed to be what was the dogma of the day, because maybe Darwinism could work with that.
I agree. I think that made the simplified view more attractive. It seemed as though if you consider proteins, which are these chains of amino acids, and there's 20 different kinds, if you consider the total number of possibilities for a chain of characters, and there's 20 characters possible at each position, these chains are not short, they're hundreds long, typically. The number of possibilities is just staggering, so far beyond anything that could have been sampled by accident, so far beyond anything that could have existed. Even if you filled the oceans with these proteins, you couldn't have sampled more than a minuscule fraction of them. And I think that realization drove people to think that they must not be, these things must not be as complicated as they look. If they came about by accident, they must be much simpler. I believe that did drive, or at least it played into this idea that they were, in fact, much simpler than they appeared.
It seems that some people, you know, God made us all differently. I'm the pastor of Denver Bible Church. I believe God made us. And some people are just naturally great at music. Others at architecture and math. And so some people could get a sense, a visceral sense of large numbers. Others, I think, don't either apply themselves or just don't have a clue. Back in the 1980s, I was at a party with some brand new engineering grads, and they had been hired at Bell Labs. And the discussion went to how many atoms are there in the universe. And so even back then, we were aware of the idea of a Google 10 to the 100th.
Right.
And so I made the statement that there's nowhere near a Google atoms in the universe. You would need billions of universes to get a Google atoms. And they laughed and they said how absurd that was. There had to be many Googles of atoms in the universe. And it wasn't until maybe 20 years later with the internet that I was able to look it up and see it's like whatever it is, I forget.
It's about 10 to the 80 is what it's thought to
10
be.
To so the well 80th below particles. Google. Yeah. And so when you have large numbers like that, if every atom in the universe were a laboratory trying to come up with a protein fold, could the whole universe come up with a good protein? That approaches the kind of problem that exists that the Darwinian world didn't want to acknowledge, but you and some others were pursuing that to try to figure out how rare is it to get a functional protein.
Correct.
So could you tell us about one of your colleagues? What a story. Miriam Altamirano had a paper published, a very significant paper, that you could take a protein and mutate it, and really it doesn't matter too much what you do to it. It's still going to perform the function that an enzyme would perform. Could you tell that story? Because I think it's crucial for people to understand the times that you were working in.
This was, I think it was 2000, the year that her paper came out. And she had done a project that really combined engineering and evolution. And remember, the center where we were working was called the Center for Protein Engineering. So it was kind of appropriate for us to think about how you would engineer proteins. And her idea, which was a common one at the time, was that if you look at two different proteins that perform different functions, you might be able to see the parts, and let's call them A and B. So protein A, enzyme A performs function A, and enzyme B performs function B. If you look at B and look at the parts of that protein that interact with the chemical that it's working on, might you be able to just clip off those parts and paste them onto protein A, replace the corresponding parts on protein A, and get protein A to do the function of protein B? People knew it wasn't quite that easy because you can fairly quickly do the clipping, the cutting and pasting. And if you do that, protein A doesn't do anything. In fact, often it doesn't even fold. But what they thought was, we probably just got a few positions wrong here. So if we allow some mutations to correct those errors in our engineered version of protein A, maybe this function of protein B will pop out. And so it's called directed evolution. You do some engineering to try to get a new function, try to get a transition in function, and then you throw some random mutations at it and try to select the new function. Well, she used that approach and appeared to have a highly successful result. It had been used before, but no one ever got anything very impressive. She got her, or appeared to have her enzyme A converted into a fully functional enzyme B. And it was published in the highly prestigious journal Nature in 2000. And I was present through this period. Now, maybe a year. Yeah, go ahead.
Doug, if I could maybe restate what you just did for the sake of the audience, not that I could do it any better, but being an amateur, you know. If you think of proteins as little molecular machines, microscopic, if you took two machines off a shelf and you grabbed a part of one and put it on the other, and you want to see if the other one will still work right. So remove part of a machine, take a part of another, put it on, see if it'll work. And that was the hope of Darwinism, that this stuff is really easy to assemble, and you can just mix and match parts, and they're all going to do their jobs. And so she tried that with laboratory techniques that are astounding, especially for the time. You know, that's back in the dark ages of molecular biology, the 1990s. And she published in the world's leading science journal, Nature, that look at this. You take one part off of a protein, take another part, slap it on, it works just fine. That was her finding, and the Darwinist approved.
Yes, and it was a lot of work. It wasn't just the cutting and pasting. She went through several rounds of this random mutation and selection. So it seemed to combine scratching your head and thinking about what would work with the evolutionary process of trial and error, random mutation and natural selection. It seemed to work so spectacularly in her case that Nature, this top-tier journal, was immediately interested in her, and her paper got published. Problems started to present themselves, as the book says. It was probably about a year or maybe a year and a half later. What happened was she, on the basis of that success, or apparent success, she got a number of graduate students who formed a group that she led, and they were all trying to take this highly successful procedure and apply it to other enzymes, other proteins. And it wasn't working very well, and I was aware of them having some issues. And there came a point where she left on vacation and she didn't return, and nobody knew what was up with that, but it left these students without an immediate supervisor. And around that time, to make matters worse, a friend of mine was investigating samples that she had left in the freezer and found that, in fact, this amazing engineered and evolved enzyme was misreported, that apparently she had contamination where the original A enzyme got in there where she thought she had her evolved, or sorry, the original B got in there where she thought she had modified A, and that's why it had the function of B. It was B.
In other words, the engineered and then left to mutate on its own enzyme that the scientific world greeted with great fanfare because it showed Darwin's theory actually functioning, it didn't do any such thing. It did nothing of the kind. When she said, look, it's functioning, it was the original enzyme.
Right.
And it's not that that was done on purpose, because these things are little and you could contaminate your specimen.
Exactly.
So the unnamed graduate student in your book, that was a friend of yours, and when this student began to dig around in the freezer and found out that the containers, the contents didn't match the labels, you know, thank God for some graduate students. And
yes, there was a huge gulp moment. Everyone was kind of shocked in the lab, because not just because we thought, oh no, what if that Nature paper was totally wrong, but because there were now, I think it was 6 graduate students who had been working for a year and a half on the assumption that that Nature result was correct. Mm. So there was a lot at stake there.
Yeah, there's lives, careers. And so when it turned out that they realized that it was a complete mistake, then there was a retraction published in Nature that in and of itself is extraordinary. Now, there are websites dedicated to the retraction of peer-reviewed papers that are published, and it's become an epidemic. But this was a really dramatic example of that. And I am thankful that, of course, that it was retracted.
That was the honest thing to do. And the head of the lab knew it was the honest thing to do. And so there was no hesitation there. But it's a hard thing to do, obviously.
So meanwhile, the Discovery Institute out of Seattle in the U.S. is making headlines, the animosity against anyone who would dare question methodological naturalism, that there is no designer, there's no intention in the universe or in biology. Everything could be explained in terms of matter and energy and the laws of physics. That's it. The Discovery Institute had a tremendous opposition, and that opposition easily crossed the Atlantic, and it ended up interfering with your work. So could you tell us a bit about that? And then what I'd like to do is maybe give you a couple minutes to make some points about the rest of your book, which is astounding, and then we'll leave the audience with a desire to run right out and get it or click over to Amazon.com. We'll put the link for them to buy the book Undeniable by Dr. Doug Axe, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life Is Designed. But articles were being published. In fact, an astounding article out of New York, the newspaper Newsday, referencing your work and referencing you by name, basically putting a target on your back.
Yeah, I don't know if the journalist thought of it that way, but that's what it felt like. So what happened was spring of 2002, there was a school, a prominent and highly regarded school, it was probably what we would call a K-12 school. That's not what they would call it in the UK. Mm-hmm. But teaching high schoolers or middle schoolers intelligent design along with teaching evolution. And this was a school that was receiving public funding. And suddenly, I don't remember what set things off, but things got set off in the UK in a way that they had previously only been set off in the US. So it had been a hot potato issue in the US, but largely ignored in the UK. Suddenly, there was this big furor, and it was being debated in the House of Commons. Tony Blair was fielding questions from people in the House of Commons on this school and on the controversy. Can a school that's receiving public money be mentioning or teaching intelligent design, even along with evolution? And so it was on the radio, BBC radio, and newspapers. And it was in that mix, great tension, that I became aware only later that there was at least one person in the lab who was urging the head of the lab, the director of the lab, Alan Furst, to remove me because of my connection to Discovery Institute. Now, this got written up in an article that came out in New Scientist magazine 2006, I think, or 2005, I'm not sure. I think it was 2006. Alan Furst revealed that there had been this person who was pressing him to remove me, and he, in the New Scientist article, says that he resisted that, and I think he probably did for some time. But things reached sort of a crescendo, all the shrill to-ing and fro-ing and all the bad press, and he did then, under pressure, remove me in March of 2002. And not giving the controversy as the reason, but simply I received a very short email saying there's been a crunch on space and we need you to vacate by the end of March.
Right. There was a crunch on space in the lab, but only you needed to vacate.
Yeah.
So it's in the book. It was a Doug Axe-shaped space.
Exactly. That needed to be vacated.
Was that Barry Pelevich you mentioned? You present an email between you and Pelevich in the book. Yeah. You put his email to you and your response. It's all extraordinary, but is that who that was? Oh, no, that was a professor
who was pressing
from
for me to
Georgia.
Be removed? Or?
Yeah, no, that was a professor from University of Georgia,
right,
who was an editor with The Scientist. That's who that was.
Right.
But
New Scientist is the magazine that had the article come out in 2006,
okay,
or so, which is not the same as The Scientist.
Yeah, thanks for clarifying that. In fact, our audience might recall The Scientist is the publication where Theodosius Dobzhansky published his classic article on evolution, Nothing in Biology Makes Sense Except in the Light of Evolution, which is somewhat humorous 40 years later, looking back at all his predictions that failed. So there was this effort. You were identified by name in the media. We skipped over the paper that you brought to the director of the lab, I think, a friend of yours, Alan, who he rejected the idea of your paper. Do I have that right? Or was that Max, the guy who helped to found the lab?
That's the 2000 paper that was Max Perutz, yeah.
And could we just quickly let the audience know what the point was in that paper? Because I think that paper has its place in the history of science.
So this is the 2000 JMB paper that I put the first draft of it. I gave it to Max Perutz, this great scientist, luminary. And in writing the paper, I realized that the idea that I was critiquing, and I had evidence to critique it, it was this simplified view that we were talking about just a few minutes ago, that maybe proteins didn't care what kind of amino acid goes where along their chains, as long as the hydrophobic ones, the oily ones or the water-heating ones, were hydrophobic, and the hydrophilic ones, the salty ones, the ones that like to be exposed to water, were hydrophilic. So in other words, if you could jumble up the exact sequence of amino acids, as long as you kept hydrophobic, hydrophobic, and hydrophilic, hydrophilic, the protein wouldn't care. That was a very common view. It was actually tied to work that Max Perutz himself had done in the late 1960s. And in introducing that idea, I referred to Max's own work, and then I proceeded to show how my experiments showed conclusively that it was false, that in fact, you ruin these proteins. Even if you keep the hydrophobics hydrophobic and the hydrophilics hydrophilic, these things fall apart if you do too many substitutions. And I was in particular looking at the exterior of these proteins. Max's work and other work had suggested that the interior was where the constraints were more extreme, and on the exterior they were very, very relaxed. And my result was showing, no, in fact, if you shuffle the exterior, even if you keep the hydrophilics hydrophilic, so you're substituting like for like within the set of 20 amino acids, these things fall apart by the time you do a handful of substitutions. Well, Max, when I did meet with him in his office, didn't like the paper, and I sat there and he complained about various things. He didn't engage the evidence because I thought the evidence was just rock solid. He just sort of complained about it. So I walked away feeling as though I had lost an opportunity to convince this great scientist that my project was worthwhile. It did get good, solid reviews from other scientists, and it was published in the year 2000 in the Journal of Molecular Biology, a very solid journal.
And so I don't think I'm overstating the case that this was a significant step in the history of molecular biology to recognize the importance of the sequence of the amino acids for the folding and functioning of a protein. Would you agree I'm not overstating the importance of that?
Well, certainly that is an extremely important fact. I will not claim anything like sole credit for bringing that fact to the light of molecular biology, but I certainly made a contribution. So yeah. To the extent that I contributed to that, my work was very worthwhile.
Yeah, extraordinary. What we take for granted today, we forget was a battle to bring this to light. And then my last question is about, well, Michael Denton, who many in our audience know, his book, Evolution, A Theory in Crisis, his work, he had put out a number that if the number was 10 to the 40th, you know, one followed by 40 zeros, if functional proteins were that rare, only one good protein out of that many possible proteins, when you rearrange the order of the amino acids, the sequence, well, then there's no way that proteins could come about by random processes that Darwinism envisions, because there's just not enough opportunity in the world, in the history of the world. And so your work, you then started to zero in on an actual number of how many good proteins are there in the set of all possible proteins. What was that number?
Yes, and in the book I say I read Evolution, A Theory in Crisis by Denton, and that was one of the works that set me on this course of trying to get the number. Mm-hmm. The number that I had published in a paper in Journal of Molecular Biology in 2004 was 1 in 10 to the 74th for functional proteins. Or if you need to get a specific function, which you always do, and in evolution you always would need to get specific functions, not just any function, it's about 1 in 10 to the 77th power. So that's well beyond Denton's 1 in 10 to the 40th.
And we're approaching the number of particles in the entire universe. And Doug, what we've talked about here on Real Science Radio with my co-host Fred Williams is that, let's say you just had this churning of chemicals and out pops this astounding photoreceptor that could actually respond to a single photon. I mean, so that's what a vision system would be based on. But so what? You have this astounding assembly, arrangement of amino acids. And unless you have a system to plug it into where you're going to produce the right number, they're going to perform their function, the function is going to be understood, it's not going to mean anything. You produce this protein, and all you have is a dead protein that's just not going to do anything. And that's the end of it. So
absolutely.
Even the concept is ludicrous when you step back and say, if this wildly rare thing ever happened, what would be the result? And the result would be nothing. You just have millions of more things produced. Everybody wouldn't stop the show and say, hey, we finally got it.
Right.
So
yeah, when you look at what needs to happen in order for even the simplest living organism to appear, it's that 1 in 10 to the 74 problem, or 1 in 10 to the 77 problem, multiplied by itself hundreds of times before you get even the simplest organism. So
right.
it's ludicrously implausible.
When we were at Oxford, we went to New College, and Richard Dawkins wasn't on the campus at the time, but we left in his faculty inbox what we call our Dawkins Evolution Challenge. And we've created these, like, we got a response from a well-known evolutionist, P.Z. Myers. He responded to our P.Z. Myers Challenge. But our Dawkins Challenge was just this. Forget about all the complexity of DNA and the genetic system and just focus on three genetic letters symbolizing a single amino acid, that 3-to-1 relationship. How might that arise in a materialist system? And our challenge on this little printed postcard to Richard Dawkins was that we propose that as a materialist, you will not be able to answer this question because this is symbolic logic, that three genetic letters always refer to a single amino acid, 3-to-1, and that's symbolism, that's information, and information is not physical, so therefore the laws of physics and chemistry could never give rise to a 3-to-1 symbolic relationship. Do you think we were overstating our case, Doug, or do you think that Richard Dawkins might have a hard time answering that?
So you're referring to the genetic code, which is this elegant mapping of the 64 possible triplets called codons of nucleotide bases, the A's, C's, G's, and T's. You take those A's, C's, G's, and T's in groups of three, and they map in a beautiful and elegant way, and actually it's been shown to be a fantastically optimal way. To the 20 amino acids and to three stop signals as well. And that's the genetic code that was elucidated in the late 1960s and early 1970s. No, you're on solid footing in challenging any materialist to come up with an explanation for that code.
Just the 3-to-1. Forget everything else. Forget how it all functions. Just the 3-to-1 symbolic relationship. And we've been asking that question for years of, you know, less famous evolutionists and atheists, and they can't even begin to think about the problem because there's no way to conceptualize it because the laws of physics have no symbolic logic functions, so they can't give rise to symbolic logic, symbolism. So, Doug, your book, could you share with us maybe another thought? And then I want to close by encouraging folks and letting them know where to get Undeniable.
Sure. A big thought, a big theme that runs through the book is that although I have spent 25 years with the help of others doing the technical work to test Darwin's theory and have come to the unambiguous conclusion that it doesn't work, specifically accidental causes cannot invent what I've come to the conclusion of, the idea behind the book is that you don't have to do that technical work, nor do you have to accept me on the basis of my experience having done that technical work, because there is a non-technical argument that shows the very same thing, that accidental causes cannot invent remarkable things. And so really the point of the book is to deliver that non-technical argument to people who don't have a scientific background, and I argue that it's not just an argument, it is scientific in nature. So we all do science at a simple level that I call common science. And if you take this common science, it's common sense reasoning coupled with real world observation and model building, you see that accidental causes really cannot invent. That's the conclusion I reach by chapter 9 of the book. And then I weave in some little snapshots of the technical science as well so that people see, I have done my homework here.
Yeah.
I just don't want to leave the argument in technical form, because if you do that, then, of course, scientists who read the book will say Axe has got it wrong, and that leaves non-scientists, non-professional scientists, in the position of wondering who to believe. Do you believe Axe, or do you believe the people who are criticizing Axe? And you have this to-ing and fro-ing that I really wanted to liberate the reader from.
Well, I love the science that you put in the book and the tutorials for people who are not familiar with your area of expertise, the amino acids, the appendages, the protein chains, the illustrations, just to help us understand what the discussion is all about. And there's one sentence in your book that I think for me sums up so much of it, that our design intuition, that life is designed, our design intuition turns out to be good science, whereas scientism or methodological naturalism, that turns out to be bad philosophy. So our design intuition turns out to be good science, whereas, let's call it atheism, turns out to be bad philosophy. What a great book, Doug Axe, and what an honor to have you here on Real Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great talking about it.
Is there a preferred place to get the book other than Amazon.com?
Amazon's fine. You can go to undeniabledesign.com for other ways to get it, through Barnes & Noble and other vendors as well, and to get more information on the book and about me.
Okay, so we'll link to that, undeniabledesign.com. And again, thank you so much, Dr. Douglas Axe.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So what a fun interview. And of course, you know, we know that Doug Axe is humble. And of course, there were other people involved in the discovery that the arrangement of amino acids in a protein are crucial for its ability to fold and to perform its function. Enzymes, a particular kind of protein. Enzymes could speed up a chemical reaction. You know, the kinds that you need to happen in your body, in your cells, millions, billions of times every second. Well, an enzyme could take a chemical reaction that might not happen. It might take 5 minutes or 5 hours or 5 years or 500 years. And with an enzyme, it might happen in a thousandth of a second. And all these proteins and enzymes that perform the astounding functions that enable life to exist, the discovery and the battle to bring it to the scientific world at large, Douglas Axe played a key role in that battle. And so today we take it for granted, but back then it could cost you your career, literally. And so what a thrill, again, to have Dr. Axe on Real Science Radio. Until next time, this is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.